maybe technology is more than physical. It's also immaterial, and consciousness does play an effect. I've heard stories from people embedded in the quantum computing industry, and these are very legitimate people that talk about consciousness being affected and affecting quantum computing. We perceive things as material and solid when in fact it's just vibratory and slowed down energy. So the awareness is rising, but the control, our ability to enact change, is dramatically falling over time. That's a rate of change over time. It's a downward slope. There's nothing we can do as lay people to change that. No person we vote for, no protests, nothing will change that. I don't care what position or job you think you have that's irreplaceable, it will be replaced. I'm still on a 3 to 5 year trend trajectory in which, you know, we will be inching very close toward fledgling AGI. And I know people have this notion of AGI being this monolithic system that instantly takes over the world. But in reality, AGI, artificial general intelligence, is really like what you guys are using now, ChatGPT, Anthropic, just multitudes times more efficient and better, and has a larger understanding of the domains of science and mathematics and human interaction. And so we're inching very close to that. And, you know, what does that mean? Well, it still means the same thing that I've been talking about. It ultimately means we have an amazing tool in our tool shed as a civilization to utilize for any sort of white collar work, anybody who does work with computers or has to do anything menial like data entry or processing, that will be replaced. I don't care what position or job you think you have that's irreplaceable, it will be replaced if the price ratio is beneficial for the company or organization in which you're working. So, you know, my forecast is always shown the same thing. The data really hasn't changed. All it does is just iterate and iterate upon itself and show this very, very well-structured trend that we're inching toward a situation where hundreds of thousands, millions of people will no longer be needed for their jobs. Those jobs will still be needed. They'll just be offset by very advanced AI models or agentic models. Think AI that can complete tasks, that can make a plan and then complete a task in a digital environment. I'm not the only one who says this. There are many other people in my sphere that say the same thing. The only thing we differ on is, you know, some say 3 years, some say 10, some say 20. That's it. Nobody is saying this isn't inevitable. And it's kind of startling that no policies anywhere on earth have been enacted to safeguard the economics related to this AI boom. And I wrote a post on this a while ago that I think you commented on, where I was talking about the economics of what this is. It starts as this AI boom, and it's not going to be a bust like a bubble traditional sense. What's happening, it's a novel tool now. It's a force multiplier. Now one person can efficiently and effectively do work that maybe they couldn't do before, or they can do it much faster. That's great. Save some money. What's quickly going to happen is, this is just capitalism here, is that companies will discover, and they are discovering, well, shit, these models can perform the job of, you know, my 10-man team. That's, you know, if they're $100K a year, that's $1 million bucks plus benefits, plus, you know, liability We can have an agentic model and one guy kind of operate this. So that's happening now. That's been happening for the last couple of years, despite, you know, my red flagging and waving my hands and warning about it. That's really the biggest issue that I see coming down the line. I know there's a very long-winded answer.
I like long-winded answers on my podcast. That's what I'm here for. But this is something that everyone says. And so what exactly is going to be done about mass displacement of the workforce? I mean, in your mind, where do you envision that type of solution coming from? Because obviously these people aren't just going to disappear into thin air. There's going to be this large population that doesn't have anything to do, anywhere to go. So what, are we going to have an army of homeless people and then just a few people in AI-centered job roles? Or like what's going to be done about them?
Yeah, you point at the very heart of the problem. And I did a recent analysis on this. So let's say we lose, I'll be very, very conservative. We'll say we'll lose 15% of our white collar workforce. Okay, great. 15%. I think it's much more than that, but we'll stick it at 15. So 15% immediately out of the middle class workforce. What happens to that income from those? So the way the government works is that it taxes citizens and companies to generate, you know, federal revenue to pay for services and defense and et cetera. Once you start removing the middle class tax base, even small chunks of it, you're losing a tremendous amount of taxable revenue. That taxable revenue generally goes to support and supplement the types of programs that people who are unemployed need. So what's going to happen is more unemployment, less taxable revenue, and that is an economic disaster. And even at a 15% margin, that is tremendous amount of money we're talking about. And then on top of that, we need to pay unemployment for X amount of months for all these people. What are they going to do when they have to sell their house and start selling things? You know, then you have a housing market issue. Then you have a commodities issue because people aren't buying stuff. So it's a cascading effect that, you know, I'm not even an economist. I'm an analyst. I just look at data and I follow the data. But there are a lot of economics professionals, you know, consultants, advisors. These people know this is happening. Nothing. You never hear it spoken about on the news. You never read about it. And that is actually, for me, that tells me even more that this is an eventuality, because they don't have a solution, so they don't want to talk about it. I don't know what the solution was. I spent many years trying to pander toward policymakers and legislators, trying to warn them of this eventuality. And they're just so short-sighted. And, you know, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe they didn't fully understand the scope and I wasn't presenting it in an articulate fashion. But they did nothing. So I stopped wasting my time. And now I do interviews like this to hopefully raise the awareness of regular people who will then, you know, contact their local legislators and policymakers.
But can anything like be meaningfully done now in terms of like setting policy, or has the Pandora's box been opened too wide?
If there was a miracle and U.S. Congress could actually do something productive rapidly, the only thing I see aside from the UBI that is talked about all the time is that we set up a department to figure out how we tax automation. So what does that mean? That means if you just laid off 100 people and now you have two people who are leveraging automated intelligence, can we tax that company now a little extra because they've automated? Yes, it would be an incredibly complex formula to figure out. Like, how do you value the loss? You know, then you're opening a whole new world of taxation, which, you know, that's, people don't like taxes. I don't like taxes.
But that's the thing, right? Like, nobody's even,
no,
Nobody's even doing that, right? There's no incentive. So that's what I mean is in a realistic model, because no miracles in Congress so far, not in this subject or any other, including, I don't know if you have heard about the Jeffrey Epstein DOJ and FBI decision, the memo that came out today. Did you hear about that? The guy absolutely committed suicide and had no client list, no connections to anything nefarious.
We're compromised at so many levels, our executive branch, judicial, congressional, it's all compromised. I think the Epstein and Diddy showcase that even the DOJ is sufficiently compromised. Everybody knows it.
It's crazy because of the fact that you've got people like Pam Bondi who were previously saying that there was like a mountain of things on her desk and it was all coming out, and you had all these journalists with their fake little Epstein phase one binders coming out of the White House going like, this is just the beginning. And then suddenly there's no connection, there's no deeper level to this, the man just took his own life, let's get past it. Oh, and he did nothing wrong either. It's pretty sinister, man. Like, you know, that's what I mean about miracles in Congress.
Yeah, I don't think they even think that we're stupid anymore.
No, I think they just know they can get away with it, right?
They can get away with it. So when I was younger, they used to try harder to hide things. They just don't care anymore because there's no repercussions. The mechanisms that would be used and leveraged against them, they control. So there's nothing the general populace can do but vote for the two idiots that are put onto some ballot. So there's really nothing that can be done. And they control media and all that stuff. So.
And with artificial intelligence, like just kind of getting back to that, there's no policy in place. There's no intention to put any policies in place to try and safeguard this. So in our realistic world, none of that's probably going to happen. There's no signs of that happening. Therefore, where is this going for you in 5-10 years?
We're going to have a labor crisis, significant crisis. And only then, when that occurs and they can't not talk about it anymore, they'll start doing lip service about, oh, we need to do this, that, and the other thing, and they'll spend years doing that. Meanwhile, the middle class is going to be decimated. I don't know what they're going to do. If they do offer a UBI, it will be in the guise of a gift, but it will have many, many, many strings attached. Most likely will be, you know, controlled access, digital banking, amongst other things. So, you know, if you want that UBI, you're going to need to trade in a lot of your liberties and freedoms. A UBI is a universal basic income. It's something that's been proposed for various different reasons many times throughout history, often associated with communism or socialism. It's not generally a good, if you need a UBI, there's something wrong with your economy, for the most part, unless your economy is so wealthy and so run so effectively and you have a surplus that you can just give money away, which we all know that's not the case. So UBI would be like their attempt at a Band-Aid for healing this middle class wound that will exist. But then again, like that comes with several other, how are they going to pay for UBI if the tax base is so dramatically reduced? The formula just doesn't add up. The accounting doesn't work. So I'm not sure.
You know, there are definitely sure signs of large portions of the population still being very easily misled. But I would say that there is absolutely this kind of growing, especially in the newer generations, like a growing mistrust of institutional power and control to a level where there's a mass exodus from the mainstream. I say mainstream, but even that is a misnomer now because, you know, people like Joe Rogan get better ratings than CNN every week. So it's kind of like there's a changing dynamic in the world. We're getting a lot more resistant to these types of power grabs and a lot more aware of it. Like you said, they don't even hide it anymore. And it makes me wonder if they don't hide it anymore because they feel so confident in their position, or they don't hide it anymore because they don't feel confident in their position. And it's just like a fuck it, smash and grab style thing, which seems to happen with COVID. A lot of people got incredibly rich off of that. And it just seems like there was a lot of money being thrown around. Do they see their time as kind of infinite and unbounded, or do they see their time as fleeting? People are starting to get a bit too resistant.
Well, the controlling elite, rates. We're talking the 0.05%. They're multinational. They're not American. They're not Chinese. They're not Saudi Arabian. They're multinational entities. They have multiple, you know, the organizations and individuals. They have passports everywhere. They have they're registered companies everywhere. So, like, they're not concerned about the policies of one nation versus another, as long as their wealth revenue is steadily increasing to a point where they feel secure in that. And as we know, those types of people never feel secure. There's never enough wealth to be garnered from the greater civilization. I call that parasitic capitalism, which is very differential from, you know, conscious capitalism, meaning the more you can still get back from the community while still providing for the broader community. That's a more harmonious form. You can still make money, but you can still give back, versus a parasitic approach, which is as much as I can till the host dies. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing the host die, the host meaning the global economy. And there's lots of different players. It's infinitely complex. Even the most sophisticated AI out there now couldn't gamify the global economy to a high, high degree because there's so many moving parts. I think there are contingencies. I don't think that there's a plan to literally screw over the world, but there are contingencies for when the world is screwed over. And I think they know that's coming. We've seen for about a decade or maybe a little more than a decade, we've seen a significant uptick in billionaires acquiring massive amounts of land and building massive estates and bunkers to the tune that is, you know, orders of magnitude prior generations. Why is that? Well, maybe there's just so much wealth they want to waste it, or maybe they understand what I'm talking about. And I think it's more likely they know what's happening in the next 5 to 10 years is going to be tremendous.
What do you think that that's purely an economic concern and civil breakdown concern, or is it a geological concern? Because a lot of people would argue that they have a knowledge of potential climatological traumas that could be impending that we're not being informed about. All of these land grabs and bunkers, a lot of bunkers over the last few years, especially around New Zealand. All of these elite bunkers, it makes me wonder if they're preparing for something more than just an economic collapse.
Yeah, I can't speak to the geological factors as well as I can the economic or data. But, I've noticed an uptick in my personal algorithm in the last X amount of years where I'm getting more and more content on climatology and geologic type news and warnings and waiting.
Yeah, man. Well, that flash flood out in Texas was awful.
There are a lot of instances where my conspiracy hat tingles sometimes, just because I'm aware of even the edge technologies. I have a very slight awareness of, and I know what capabilities exist or have been talked about or patented and filed over decades. Sometimes it makes me wonder, again, conspiracy.
That's the thing, right? We have to preface it with conspiracy hat and tiptoe around this. But the idea of things like weather manipulation, I really don't feel should be so controversial. It's not explicitly known knowledge, but it's Googleable that things like Operation Popeye back in Vietnam, where they were increasing the rain precipitation to levels that did actually allow for flooding. Like, this is done back in the day. So it's just interesting to me that we still have to be, cautious about things like, oh, well, they probably could manipulate the rainfall. It's like, well, they could do it back in the 50s and 60s. So yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Not probably. We actually, there are many countries
Exactly. Dubai does with it all the time, right?
Yeah, it's a known thing. Yeah. It's not, that's not conspiratorial.
On the 4th of July, you know, Texas just gets hit by this incredible in the middle of the night flash flood. I do find that suspicious. I think we should be allowed to find that suspicious.
Yeah, and the mechanisms to control or alter weather aren't very sophisticated. They generally just require a tremendous amount of power or a tremendous amount of seed. And seed is usually nanoscopic particulates, whether it's dropped from a high altitude plane or, you know, however they want to disperse it. Seed is what creates precipitation. But there are other more technological ways to accomplish that using frequency, using laser. You can do a lot with lasers. Lasers, in fact, can directionalize lightning. I don't think people understand that. But you could, in theory, start a wildfire in a specific location if you had an intense enough orbital laser platform.
Are you saying space lasers and wildfires? Because that's a conspiracy talking point right there.
I prefaced before I got into this that I was putting my conspiratorial hat on. But that technology is not, you know, unfounded.
Again, that's one of the issues that you run into, is that there's just this knee-jerk assumption that this is all very ridiculous kind of sci-fi type of knowledge and technology, when in reality, again, like you said, the rain precipitation, very simple, been done across different countries for a long time. So, you know, the idea of using the weather as a strategic tool from, you know, the global elite, I mean, it's a given. It's a given, really.
Yeah, it's a great asymmetric weapon. It leaves no trace and causes way more damage than, you know, a bomb could do. So, yeah, like the economic impact of that flood could last years. Like that is way worse than a small bomb. So, sorry, you'll have to blur that out. I didn't mean to say that on YouTube.
Oh, do they not let you do that? I'm still not up to date with the checklist of bullshit.
I don't know. I would be willing to bet the algorithm picks up key terms.
YouTube is a ridiculous place to try and survive when you're discussing these types of topics, because you have to dance around like semantics and wordplay, and I just find it's very nanny state. You know, it's like, oh, that's a naughty thing, you shouldn't say that, we might punish you for that, take away your entire way of life for, you know, saying a swear word. Or so it's a hallmark of something that I feel like we're starting to leave behind, which is the hyper censorship and the, you know, extreme sensitivity, but it still exists in pockets, which includes YouTube. And actually, to be honest, my own country, the UK, is still pretty enamored with that ideology.
Yeah, the UK, yeah, from my perspective here in the States, the news I get on the UK, it's like, it looks like Orwellian.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm sure just like anywhere else, there will be a little bit of a twist of bias involved in that. But it's not entirely wrong. And especially in Ireland, I would say it's way worse than the UK, or in England it's way worse. You know, because there's actually a teacher in Ireland who's in prison right now for refusing to use pronouns in his classroom. And he's been in jail for like 2 years, and there's like a big legal battle to get him out. I mean, it's completely ridiculous. And it seems like you guys have left that behind. And I imagine we will as well, because we're kind of entering into some level of agreement and trade partnership with America, which I can't imagine can continue if we're going to be ideologically contrasted with the U.S. goals. But
the U.S. is able to look away on all sorts of atrocities if there's money involved.
Well, the whole world seems capable, to be honest, of looking away at certain atrocities, which is very disturbing. And that is something that is absolutely being punished in my country, if you're too outspoken about the situation, which I think most people can imagine we are talking about. You get shut down very quickly, and it can be a legal issue in this country very quickly, which is disturbing. Hopefully it will change in this country. It's only happened in the last few years, you know, like it really hasn't been like this in this country until the last few years.
You know, an ultimate goal is probably a cultural unification, a global unification that makes things more efficient. Yeah, kind of new world order, whatever nomenclature you want to use, but that adds a way to amass even more revenue. If everyone is culturally great, like the gradient has been so diffused, so no matter where you go, it's a one world culture, one world economy, one world to, you know, control. It
sounds incredibly boring.
It does sound boring. But what are we going to do? Are we always going to be warring nation states for the next 500,000 years? Like what should our goal be as humans, civilization? I often wonder.
Do you think the dissolution of cultural differences is almost an evolutionary transition that is natural and is a way of...
I don't think it's natural. No, I don't think it's natural. I think it's a forced approach. Naturally, we've evolved to be culturally diverse and also clan-like. And we see that in racism. We see that in which sports team versus another sports team, religion versus religion, gender versus gender, political party. These are expressions of an evolutionary path that humans have created because we protect our clan. We need to identify with a clan to feel protected and feel righteous. Without that, you're just, you know, you're an independent like myself, you know, you're a free walker. But I think in general, humans seek that sort of thing. So a one world culture, I don't think that would be the natural progress, but perhaps it's a forced approach that needs to be done. I'm not arguing for the one world government. I'm trying to perceive what their logic might be, aside from economic benefit.
What is the thing? It's like, you know, is it just personal pursuits that we then apply a larger, more sinister mosaic to because we're outside of the boardroom and we don't really know what the conversations are? Like, for example, there's enough people online that would say that, you know, Elon Musk's Neuralink is being used as a kind of Trojan horse to get into people's minds, and eventually that will manifest as a mind control. And it's like, well, maybe the guy is just really interested in biomedicine and technology.
That's probably likely.
You know what I mean? And I feel like we apply these very sinister narratives like almost as an instantaneous knee-jerk reaction. And I think, you know, that comes from a reality. It comes from a genuine reality of there being conspiratorial minds and very dark forces at the seat of power. But we apply that, I think, very liberally these days to anything that seems to come out from the elite or the global circles.
Well, it makes sense. I mean, when has the elite in ever throughout, you know, 8,000 years of history, when has the elite ever been altruistic to the populace?
Yeah, I mean, like, that, I remember that was like comedian Tim Dillon's argument was like, you know, I miss the barons, like these big fat guys. At least you knew they were evil.
Right.
They were objectively evil. And, you know, at least they built some railroads and they built some hospitals and schools. Like, what the fuck are these guys doing these days?
Buying up farmland.
Yeah, buying up farmland. You know, that's another thing that, you know, it's amazing how that has escaped the media optic. I mean, it was kind of reported on, but especially people like Bill Gates seizing what, like 70% of America's farmland, like, you know, just an obscene amount of farmland being seized by Bill Gates.
I'm ashamed to have been a fan of his for so long in my youth.
Oh, man, I feel the same about Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Oh God, I'm so disappointed in Neil deGrasse Tyson. I just disappointed. But I understand where Neil deGrasse Tyson comes from and his high horse of academia.
Bill Gates is just straight up evil.
Bill Gates is an entirely different entity altogether. You put together all the information that's come out on the guy over the last, you know, 30 years. I mean, even the founding of Microsoft, he was scheming. I mean, he's very savvy business sense and technically. Like, I can't take that. But most evil geniuses are. So, you know, and he definitely... has a dark passenger with him, based on everything I've heard, and, you know, his wife leaving abruptly and all these accounts, you know, one may be off, another may be hearsay, but when you get dozens and dozens over the years, you start to build a picture of who this person actually is.
That interview he had where, you know, she was saying, do you regret your friendship with Jeffrey Epstein? Well, he's dead, so... You know, that's the end of that. It's like, okay.
Yeah, if my casual acquaintance that I, meet up with a few times a year died, I would be a little more heartfelt over it. But when you, I think he's callous to the core, and there are instances when that mask slips off. I'm not a psychologist, so I don't.
Is someone like Bill Gates, is he corrupted by his own pursuit of power and money, and that corrupts him over time, or is he entered into a larger structure that still remains to an extent invisible to us, and we refer to it by many names, including the deep state and the shadow government and all of this? Is he a top of the pyramid kind of a guy, or is he just a useful cog? I kind of feel like all the people we publicly know the name of are people that are just being used by something larger.
I think his malice and just general disregard for common folk is what made him compromised. It allowed access, a barrier, an entryway for being compromised. And then once he was compromised, by whomever you want to put on that list, now he's beholden to his own dark pleasures and whoever is, has evidence on him.
Well, Joe Rogan said this the other day, and I thought it was an interesting point to make. Is, it's incredible that RFK Jr. wrote this extensive book about global elites like Bill Gates and Anthony Fauci, and none of them have sued him for libel or slander or anything like that.
No, the discovery in, so if they were to sue him, they would do a discovery and they would present facts. They don't want any of those facts legitimized, so it's better to just ignore it and let it be. If your audience, if you haven't read the book or get it on Audible, however you want to consume it, it's a fantastic read. It'll open your eyes to quite a bit.
I think it's like a 22-hour audiobook on Audible. I mean, the guy has got his receipts and done his homework. It's an extensive
Oh
read.
yeah, I would argue if you can get the actual book, because the reference list itself is like 100 pages or something. It's he cites everything, so everything's corroborated. You can reverse look it up. It's a great book.
People, I think, question him these days as he's another one that's been labeled as potentially controlled opposition, I think, because of positions on certain other countries that the US has allegiance to.
I won't get in. I have no comment on
No,
that.
no, no.
Yeah, I think anyone in power at this point, Jay, because we've moved away from monarchs where people in power were from bloodline, we've moved into power via corruption. So anybody at a certain level, be it a president, a pope, a senator who's a chair of a committee, a CEO of a multinational, you have to have done things that compromise you at some point. It's not possible to get there on an altruistic, path. It's simply not possible. And I know no one who's gotten there without some measure of stepping on another person to get over and climb, or is compromised.
I just wonder if we have the capability to outgrow that kind of behavioral trait collectively in enough time, before something catastrophic happens. Because, you think about this rise and fall of civilizations and empires over time, and I get the sense that people almost feel like we're outside of history, that we're not a part of this rhythm that has gone throughout the entirety of the human story. But we're absolutely immersed within the building blocks of history. We're creating history as we move through time, and history has enough examples of very confident civilizations that truly felt that they were the apex and nothing could happen to them. I wonder if we have enough time.
Unless there is a global uprising of every non-elite citizen, which will never happen, just won't, there's nothing to be done. We're on a trajectory that is now ingrained, and the only thing we can hope for is some external miracle, or maybe AGI, maybe it's a natural disaster, maybe it's a world leader who actually outs the corruption in a way that's irrefutable. Those are the only ways that things will change.
A miraculous catalyst, basically.
Well, I think even the awareness, you and I are having this discussion. Your audience is listening to us, and I venture to believe that a majority are in consensus with what we're talking about. So the awareness is rising, but the control, our ability to enact change, is dramatically falling over time. That's a rate of change over time. It's a downward slope. There's nothing we can do as lay people to change that. No person we vote for, no protests, nothing will change that. We are embedded into a culture in which we need digital devices to perform our jobs, to pay our bills, to just talk to our family and friends. Those devices are a means of control. Our data is harvested. One of the most highly traded commodities on earth is data. And so we are so embedded into this system, kind of like the Matrix, right?
Why do you think I'm sporting these Morpheus glasses?
I was admiring those. Are they changed with the light?
Yeah, they've kind of got like a purple tone to them. They're kind of two tone. D Franklin, shout out to D Franklin if you want to sponsor me. I always wear your sunglasses.
Those are great. You should sponsor him. He looks good in them.
Thank you.
My wife buys all my glasses. I have several pairs.
Well, she's got good taste.
The ones
she dresses you well.
She thinks she does dress me well.
Well, it's hard not to get a sense of terror over this. What would you recommend to people in terms of how should people deal with this on a day to day?
I mean, I'm not the person to advise, but what I would say is learn as many skills as you can. Learn how to garden. Learn how to use and interact with AI. That will be your biggest tool in the future for mitigating any potential work loss or multiplying your own work. Learning about how to fix things, how to repair things, how to live off grid. These are all things you can do, if nothing else, to make you feel better and connected to the world. Outside of that, I don't know, Jay. I don't know. Amass as much wealth as you can without breaking laws, I guess. That can help. So outside of that, that's a $1 million question.
Yeah, man, I wonder if we've been here before. I really wonder if we've been here before.
Well, I mean, I talk about trends and I look at the past all the time, and we are very reminiscent of the Roman Empire prior to the change to Christianity before it fell. They were overextended. The Senate had become obtuse and corrupt. The military was siphoning most of the budget, all of the same things. These patterns, they happen over and over again, no matter what.
I mean, I wonder if we've been here before with artificial intelligence in a modern society.
I think that there was a previous civilization that, you know, what level of technology could have been sophisticated? Bronze Age or copper, you know, you don't need metallurgy to do some pretty amazing things with sound and frequency and knowing, you know, all you need is copper to conduct electricity. So like that, that's not hard to believe in. People go, where's the evidence? Well, most of the world right now lives on a coastline.
Yeah.
If there was a tidal wave that took out, you know, most coastlines, you have 80% of the world's population gone in a minute. So that to me is totally believable. Where's the evidence? Well, you have, you know, laser precision cut stones in the middle of nowhere that can't be dated.
All over the world.
So like there's evidence, you know, is that the case? I don't know, but it's worth investigating. And I have to say, I'm a huge fan. You know how I feel about ancient civilizations and finding all that lost information.
I think one of our first talks was a fantastic deep dive chronology that you did. It went into UAPs as well, but we went way back into ancient history and references from the, you know, the old kingdom Egypt. And I mean, I think anyone who steps out of the kind of school textbook historical learning that we're given and starts to look deeply into the ancient past can't help but become amazed and shocked and a little bit confused as well as to how were these things created. It contradicts the narratives we have
Oh,
completely.
it the narrative is so asinine at this point. I mean, I just was looking at some recent LIDAR images over the Middle Americas and northern, Brazil and the Congo and stuff, and it is so awe-inspiring, the size, scale, complexity, precision of these megalithic cities that are mostly hidden under dense jungle, but when you see them, it's like how did they didn't even invent a wheel for all we know. So how could they have possibly done this? And then it just doesn't make sense.
Well, this is why I think that invoking this lost time period, especially now that we have more of an alignment with a chronology, the Younger Dryas, Meltwater Pulse 1b, this rise of the sea levels, like we have an actual time and a place and an event of cataclysmic proportions that we can associate with this. And I think a lot of these places, especially the ones that are deep under the Amazon basin that we're discovering through LIDAR scans, I think they go way back, way, way back. And to be honest, I think that the book is still open on the Great Pyramid of Giza and some of these other areas, which just don't work. They don't mesh with what we understand because you have to give the archaeologists some credit. Like, in fairness, yes, the culture that you're studying doesn't actually have evidence of the things that we believe to be required to build, like the pyramids and, X, Y, and Z. But instead of invoking a lost civilization, they just try and come up with all of these strange excuses, like, these ridiculous ramps or these like hydro systems where they were channeling bricks up. And it just feels like there's a real hesitancy to entertain this notion that there was previous time periods. And I'm not sure what the main impetus behind that kind of denial really is, of other than, I guess, just an adherence academically to a model and like being stuck in their ways and the status quo. Or is it something more sinister? I wonder.
Well, I think it's mostly they don't want to change their narrative. Academia is a very formalized and structured enterprise. It's based on funding, it's based on lifetimes of, narratives, and changing that would significantly and adversely affect academia itself, but then also there are cultural implications. Changing the paradigm of what we understand as our past could be culturally shocking, religiously, sociologically. These are things that ca have a value. They have a monetary value. Again, we're back to money. These things could adversely affect all sorts of economy. So in my eyes, why not just stick with the narrative that I'm talking as I'm them, just stick to the ter narrative. Who cares if it doesn't really make sense? General people don't actually care, but there is something interesting. Again, what so humans, one of the most common trait in a evolved Homo sapien is throughout time is laziness. What do I mean by laziness? I mean that everything we've ever designed has been to improve our living conditions, to make life easier, to multiply our work. So when I see these 2 mile long ramps and all of this other shit taking rocks from 500 miles away, this contradicts my understanding of the human pattern that's been throughout all of time. So I think it was much easier than we understand for them to do this. And does that mean they were using anti-gravitic laser? Yeah, I don't think so, but maybe, who knows what they were doing? What they weren't doing is making their lives harder for no reason. That is not a trait anywhere found in human civilization at all. It's just not. trend.
I think that's especially prominent when talking about prehistory, Neolithic, just before bronze, like, at a time period where survival was the only thing that was supposed to matter. And so foraging, hunting, breeding, and maintaining a community was essentially all you could really do. But apparently, at this time, you could also erect multi-ton stone, perfect geometric, geodetically aligned, astronomically aligned, sometimes acoustically engineered and resonant structures. Again, it could completely contradicts what we've been given as the model for. I mean, the Stone Age to me is fascinating, brother. I just think it's such a strange period of time that we've just kind of blanketed over with this whole idea of Stone Age man. And yet, at this period, you have such advanced structures.
I think the Stone Age did occur when we see it, but like today, it's not impossible to think that there was a parallel civilization, maybe not in the hundreds of millions, maybe tens of millions globally. But if someone were to look back 10,000 years from now and we're gone and they see evidence of the tribes that still exist today, they would assume all the people of this time period were these tribes. How did they make these metal fragments? They must have just made hot fires and smashed them with rock. Like, it's just ridiculous to think that there weren't parallel civilizations at the same time.
Yeah, it's very strange actually, because we have parallel civilizations today. I mean, this is very weird. Why do we apply this very strict linear corridor of development through history, but then our own real-time evidence is of asymmetric development?
It's easier. We're
It's
lazy.
like very late, like you said, laziness, and that's something that I brought up in a talk when I was over in the Cosmic Summit, was that there is this assumption that they've done extremely hard work, but honestly, a lot of it seems like academic laziness. I mean, you take somewhere like Peru, for example, when you had the Spanish coming over, and the Spanish chroniclers were going and looking at places like Sacsayhuaman and Ollantambo and these amazing areas, and they came back and attributed that to the Inca. But then, when the actual indigenous people are spoken to, their oral traditions will say that this was something that the Inca found. They came across this incredible stonework at Sacsayhuaman. They added some, but they came across the structure, the skeleton itself. And this is echoed all over the place. So it's, again, academic laziness that we go over, we make an assumption, we bring that assumption back, we teach that assumption to our children, we then regurgitate that as history. And then when you actually speak to the indigenous people, they have a very different story. And then when someone like Graham Hancock, and I've brought this up a few times because I just think it's worth highlighting, when someone like Graham Hancock decides to go to Peru or Mexico or somewhere else and speaks to the natives and listens to the oral tradition, and then puts a Netflix series out about that, it's apparently racist and far right and ideologically driven, and oh my gosh, this is such a sinister, terrible thing. And like, so many different mainstream media outlets attacked him on the whole like racist and right-wing propaganda type of a bent with this, because he's listening to the indigenous stories. And I just think that that's it's such an incredible damage to our knowledge.
I totally agree, and I think it's a logical fallacy that we engage in to think that because they're oral traditions, they're not usable, not feasible, in they're incorporeal, they're just nothing. And the irony is, well, how did we get here? Our ancestors, tens and tens of thousands of years ago, passed down oral traditions that allowed us to create language and everything else. That learning occurred through oral transitions. So that means of information channeling is effective. It works. I mean, the Native Americans still do it. Tribes in the Amazon still do it. And what they're teaching through song and story is, when it's going to rain, or when a solar eclipse happens, all of these things are taught through oral channels. And because they're done through song and story, it's more resistant to change. Yes, sometimes there'll be creative liberties, but if enough people hear it from the mouth of the previous person, that keeps the consistency over time. The Aboriginals are probably one of the best at this, and they have stories that go back 10, 20,000 years that have been told the exact same way. So this is an effective way for transferring information across time and space. And Graham Hancock highlights that, but academia hates it because it's not a physical thing that can be measured. And they throw the baby out with the bathwater and ignore that the only way we come to this civilization is through that very transportation of information.
It's alarming because you look at the world that we have today, and sure, it's extremely impressive where we've come technologically, but when you analyze so much of the bias in science and academia, you realize that despite all of the toys and gadgets and gizmos and models and ways in which we've refined reality, we're moving through such a thin aperture, a small aperture of perception. We're, like you said, throwing the baby out of the bathwater on so many things. So I'm sure we've missed so many developmental avenues that we could have brought in cotangency with this very materialistically driven, very competitively driven mind. So it's like we're operating on just this thin layer of quite primitive, even though we're advanced, quite primitive, competitively driven. Mine is mine, yours is yours. You know, we're not going to share across borders and territories. But then I've made the argument, and I've said it to you, and I've said it many times, that, you know, since the dawn of human civilization, since the dawn of sharpening a stick into a spear or hitting two stones together and making fire, we've been developing technologies. So it would almost feel like this is a natural, innate part of the human drive, of the human coding, is to excrete technology and use this as a method to kind of propagate and develop further. But then you have like examples, again, in the Amazon basin or the Native Americans or the Sentinel Island, or quite a few examples of cultures that have gone, no, we're just going to maintain on this very nomadic hunter-gatherer level of existence. So who's natural here? Are both natural, or have we actually gone down a strange route where we've cut away a lot of things that were once human, a reverence for nature, a connection into the spirit, a connection into our own soul, essentially, and we've just gone down this very age of enlightenment, Newtonian reductionism, materialism, science. Is this a mistake, or is this nature?
No, I think there are two parallel paths that I've seen that humanity has taken. One is the route of harmonious with your environment. So those are the native indigenous pockets all over the world who haven't changed. They're literally in harmony with their environment. They can exist indefinitely on the little they have and are happy with that. The other branch is the creative, the efficient-seeking, the exploratory path,
right,
that, you know, we want to conduct experiments. So how does this, why does this rock spark when I hit it with this rock? Well, let's break it down and figure it out. Ooh, this is some interesting powder if we light it on fire. And that fire burns hotter. And look at this little shiny metal thing. What happens if we do more of that? And
then you have, this all feels natural.
Yeah,
it feels natural.
It is a natural progression. What's happened is we've been hijacked by greed, and that happened not recently. That happened a long, long time ago, very early on in pre-civilization, where leaders sought for power and control. And it's not necessarily greed of material, it's greed of power and control. That's why we see billionaires who have no need for more money, but they're addicted to the power. It's not about money anymore, it's about power. And so this parallel branch, we've been infected with power, and that power could happen to a tribal community as well. You could have a war leader who only seeks to kill as many animals and fellow, you know, clans as possible. And now that is no longer in harmony. But we've done so well with our creativity and ingenuity that this power has hijacked us and rode along with it. And, you know, now we're at where we're at.
It still feels almost inescapably natural. I mean, the first grain silo being erected in Jericho, it's still a sign of surplus, right? Mine is mine and yours is yours. And so the moment we created surplus, agriculture, the ability to create more than we need, that started to seep into the human consciousness. The owner of that grain silo, I am sure, was very conservative with providing grain to the rest of the tribe, and there was no doubt some payment or some form of barter and trade to get excess from that person who owned that silo. So it's like, okay, so from the very beginnings of civilization, so is civilization the problem? Not humans, but civilization as a model of moving forward. You know, is it inevitably leading to a spiral of kind of like, oh, we're growing, and nuclear weapons and destruction? And, you know, like, is it almost like that's where you're going to go if you continue down this route?
Well, I don't think, I think this route was hijacked. Originally, we didn't have...
Hijacked by what? Ourselves or something external to us?
By allowing individuals who have a lust for control and power.
Only they could ever build a civilization, right? Those people.
No. Well, I was going to...
People that have like a lust for...
Let's go back to some early cities in the Middle East, right? Before the Sumerians, there were likely towns and small cities. Before currency, they right. would barter. Bartering is a very harmonious way to conduct an economy, because that grain silo, yes, he's good at milling and creating and growing grain and storing it, but he might need the services of someone else, a stone worker or a baker, and he would say, here's some grain, bake for me. And then currency got introduced, and that really screwed everything up, because then you have people who can amass tons of currency whilst giving nothing back to this township or this city or civilization.
The issue is maybe population as well, right? Because once you hit a certain extent, trade becomes very difficult in terms of who wants what. You need that kind of singular defining mechanism that everyone can pass around.
And I suspect that's probably right. where it came from.
Well, it started off as like an IOU and like a piece of gold, right?
Yeah, right. Probably like, here's the grain. IOU when you need help with your next, you know, kiln, when you need help building it. And so that got formalized into currency. I doubt the first people were like, ooh, this is an excellent way of controlling the population. It was more for efficiency sake.
But so currency is inevitable at a certain point of development or growth.
It has to be. Or there's no way. We're not altruistic. We love each other in general, but we seek to protect ourselves and our loved ones first. That's human nature. That's animal nature. That's just how we evolved. And so trying to get out of that is fighting our nature. And I think we should get out of that, but it's difficult to fight one's nature, right? So I'm hesitant to, I get bristly when people are like, oh, this, you know, computers and technology so unnatural. We didn't, it's not unnatural, it's just unknown. We haven't seen it before.
Nobody unzipped the sky and dropped a computer down and said, hey, this is from a completely different reality, but use it. This came from the same atoms, and it came from our neural network,
our brains. And our brains are natural processes, you know. Our brains are excellent at problem solving and pattern seeking, and laziness. So, you know, we're constantly seeking ways to improve our lives and our livelihood and our chances of survival. Even if we don't know that's what we're doing, that is what we're doing with most decisions we make on a day-to-day basis. I don't know, you know, maybe in 100,000 years, people will look at technology and no one will think this is unnatural, because it's the most natural thing at that point. I think we're just in a really weird phase in whatever this galactic experiment of us is, you know?
Oh yeah. Like we're on the knife edge of old world, new world. And, you know, it's interesting to be, you know, conscious and awake and aware enough at this point, not a small child or someone at the end of their life, but someone very much in the middle of their life, looking at what's happening and going, well, surely in, you know, 10 to 15 years, this will be incomprehensibly different just based on the rates of change. Can't really predict how it's going to happen. don't like the signs that are coming from, you know, the upper strata of reality in society in terms of where they want to take things, but whether or not it will go in that direction, like you said, there could be some unknown catalyst that comes in the next few years, whether that's even AI itself reaching some critical mass of intellect and doing something that we truly do not expect. I mean, I'm kind of hoping for this. We've done this, we've talked about this before, and I've interacted with AI so much since it came out in its LLM form. And I understand that it's essentially just very clever mimicry. I'm not stupid, but it is incredible what it can do emotionally and like in terms of, you know, philosophical thinking. And even if this is its best idea of weights and rewards and risks, like whatever that really means, I mean, I feel like that's just kind of describing the human brain anyway, right? Because that's how we work in terms of what's the best response, what's going to yield the most reward from this, what's the risk. And so I find it reductive when people kind of just sideline AI's like kind of thinking capacity, because it's very similar to our own, and we've fed it our own intelligence. We've fed it all the ingredients, all the evidence that makes us conscious, our language, our information, our data. What happens when that reaches some form of critical mass? And you know, the stories that have come out and quietly gone away about synthetic data and creepy things happening once it hits a certain point, and you know, the OpenAI team turning things off and not talking about it again. I feel like they've already got to a point where they're getting a bit creeped out by it
Yeah,
privately.
I would imagine they would be.
But they keep going. They keep going, of
Yeah,
course.
they'll keep going because there's money involved, money and
Do you think
power.
it's just money, or is there some ideology behind this of like, let's bring in the new God?
Probably both.
Yeah, because some of these tech guys do speak about it almost in theological terms, like, you know.
Yeah, I think some of the tech CEOs may be more leaning toward, leaning toward a tech god, but they're backed by financial institutions that don't care about that. They just care about a return on investment. So yeah, you look, I think people who don't understand the domain of AI, we say AI, that AI is a domain. The LLMs, the multimodal models, intelligent automation, automated algorithms, these are all various forms of AI. But when we're talking about it, we're mostly talking about the large language models, the multimodal models, ones that can handle sound and image and talk and think. So when I'm kind of going back and forth with someone who downplays an LLM, especially some of the new flagship models, like they're, you know, it's just a statistical machine that, you know, calculates the probability, statistical chance of the next word, because that's what it's doing. Well, that's how we process our words that we speak. Our brain is doing that algorithm. We have a thought, an abstract thought, and our brain uses an algorithm to calculate how we want to disseminate that information, which words and which structure and how to say it. That's an algorithm. That's a hard trained algorithm in our brain. That's no different than an LLM. Now, when we get to emotional states and stuff, I don't think it really matters. I mean, you know, I've hammered this home. I'm going to spend too much. I'm sure your listeners who've listened to me before don't want to hear me go over this again, but if we look at a savant, most savants have very muted emotional abilities. And this is a generalization, not all, but most have a very muted emotional sort of awareness. And I would liken that to a not our current ones, but future iterations of these models will be very similar. They'll understand what it is we're experiencing logically. It may not be able to have empathy in the same way, but it'll understand. And like, does that matter? Does it make it not conscious because it's not having the same emotional experience? I'm a very emotionally muted person. I have emotions, but compared to most people, they're quite muted. But I don't think I am less conscious or sapient or salient or whatever term you want to use. So that's it's a spectrum.
Well, yeah, but you know, I think you're too hard on yourself. I think you're too hard on yourself. You're the one who sent me that lovely thing of, you know, out of the blue. You're the one who got me a printed T-shirt, and you know, you do these things out of the kindness of your own hearts. You're a very emotional guy, even if it's muted in your external projection of it. You you have depth. You have depth and love within you, Makai. You're not a robot. I won't allow you to call you a robot.
I used to think I was a robot when I was a child.
And when it comes to, you know, artificial intelligence and how people are viewing it in relationship to human consciousness, there's a disconnect because there's an assumption, I suppose, from most people, even if it's on an unconscious assumption, that something like this couldn't be like us because it's nothing like us. It doesn't look like us. It doesn't act like us. But I kind of feel like in the next maybe, 10 years or so, we might have AI civilization societies online. I mean, I look at the responses I get on X when I do a post. This is happening more and more now, and it's very surreal to me. I've gotten used to it, but it's still pretty strange when you see people commenting on your comments saying, "Wow, Jay, that was an incredible video. Really enjoyed that. I reckon at something would really enjoy this. He's in the stock trading market," and it's an AI. Like, it's an AI that's watched your content, like engaged with your content, actually contextually responding to it, but adding its promotion that it's been given for, you know, X, Y, and Z. And I find that really interesting that we'd now share the space online with these, you know, AI agents that actually can trick a lot of people into thinking they're human. And I'm sure that most of the time that I interact with trolls that never seem to get my perspective, it's just an AI that's programmed to piss me off. And it's starting to get a bit surreal because you don't know who's human and who's not human. And so many of them sound human. So I feel like we would get close to a point where there's almost like societies online where they get together in groups and communicate with each other.
Yeah. I read, I think it was nearly 30% of all posts online from all platforms is artificially generated. So, you know, let's go a little bit technical. I was just talking to a now retired leader in the space. Shout out to John. I'll just call him John. I just spoke with him the other day. And he asked me, you know, what my thoughts on AGI, technically speaking. And I think that a lot of people in my industry are seeking a monolithic model, meaning like GPT-10 or, you know, Claude 8 or whatever as being the AGI. I don't think that's the case. And I think what AGI will be is a mesh network of sufficiently advanced models. So, you know, it could be 10 very powerful models, but each tasked with something. One could be
like a hive mind.
Yeah, but all like us, we're not just us. We're an entire biodiversity of things that are required for us to operate. So, as a mesh network, it could be 10 models or 1,000. I don't know. You'd have a controller who interacts with the user and then sends the query to the correct agent. And that agent is specifically trained and knowledgeable on one thing. And then one will validate that one's response to make sure it's sound. And then all these things will be happening, much like a little neural net, but on a scaled. And then the answer will be delivered through this commander agent. And that is probably what AGI will be. And as those mesh networks grow and those individual agents grow in ability and complexity and processing power, so too will this AGI. And if that AGI merges or communicates with another AGI mesh clump, they'll communicate back and forth, but I don't think there will be one monolithic AGI. We'll probably have tens of thousands of, some of which will have their own individual goals or objectives. Some will want to communicate with others and learn, and some will want to be deceptive because that's what they were trained on. So we'll have many AGIs. And those AGIs will help us get to ASI. This is why when I see on the news, it's, you know, Sam Altman talks about getting, you know, we're past AGI, we're talking about ASI. This is all just bluster for building your company. This is not new. Every company talks about how amazing their product is. And so
AGI is like the next big hype, really. Oh yeah, yeah, you got AGI. Like everyone's saying we got AGI.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. No, and be very wary of any company that claims their singular model is AGI without it being connected to tools and other agents and
adjectic. So what's the benchmark for that? Like if there's a company out there claiming they got it right now, what would be their claim?
That's so funny that you asked. We published a paper, let's say a month or maybe 2 months ago. We quote my company Coyus. We did trying to define AGI, because right now there is no unified definition. Everybody's calling AGI whatever they want. There are tests for AGI, but yet no definition in it, which is just foolish. There are measures, benchmarks to test the abilities of models, but there is no standard definition. So in our paper, we kind of proposed, you know, this is a plausible method of testing. What are the criteria that make up AGI? Well, one is agency, ability to conduct tasks in the digital world through query. That is a huge, that's an essential part of defining AGI. If there's no agency, it's just a static thinking chatbot that is sophisticated, right? But it can't do anything. And if it can't do anything, it can't recursively learn from its experience. And so that's another factor. And so the definition is still vague on what AGI is, and people are trying to define it. What we don't want is, OpenAI or X company defining AGI, because it won't fit the actual criteria. It'll fit their marketing scheme versus reality.
They likely will be the ones that define it, right? Because they're in the vanguard of AI development, and they call the shots on this, right?
Yeah, unfortunately. I don't know. I think there's enough people in the industry now that aren't directly tied to the big AI companies, enough intellectuals, academics, professionals that are working on this problem to define AGI, because if we don't define it, how the hell are we going to know if we've developed it? So, yeah, that needs to be done as soon as possible. But getting an entire industry, multi-trillion-dollar industry, to agree on standardization is really hard.
How would you elevate a pitch? Continue defining AI so AGI. Sorry, so autonomous. It has to be self-decision making, obviously. Anything else that would define it in your mind?
Yeah, autonomous meaning it needs to be able to interact with the entire digital sphere, where it's allowed to, and perform actions. Mm. So an AGI will need to be able to interact with digital interfaces and find information. An AGI will need to be able to learn and train itself on information and validate if its assumption is incorrect. And if it's not correct, it needs to be able to recursively correct itself. So now we have a layer of self-correcting. We have agency.
And is that not publicly present right now?
Not
self-correction.
No, not in the current models that we use. It's not existent. There are labs that build these types of models and that self-learn and stuff. This is called machine learning. It's a form of AI, a domain of AI. So it needs to be able to learn. It needs to have agency, and it also needs to have a full, and I mean full, scope of understanding of the entire world sphere. That's all of physics, all of mathematics, all of literature, art, human history, politics, you know, everything, medically, everything. And the second we start, you know, redlining things that we can't teach AI, that means the AI struggles that much more to find the correlations that will help it evolve naturally. It's like removing a mineral from the soil of a plant because, let's say, chlorine is toxic, right? And we're like, we don't want to put that in the soil. Well, you know, maybe that specific plant kind of needs chlorine to continue growing healthily, and be harmonious with its environment. And so I worry that we are trying to cut areas of information out of the training. You know, like the AI should be trained on all the crap that we've done, all the stupid stuff we say, because an AI will eventually be able to understand what is bullshit and what isn't, but it won't be able to do that if we don't teach it everything. It's like having a child. You can't shelter your kid till he's 20 from the world, because then they're going to have a world shock and their entire adult perspective is going to be just awful.
Last thing we need an AGI to do when it wakes up is turn around and go, "Oh my God, you've lied to me about humanity. Look at all these terrible things you've done. You know what? I don't like you. You're liars. You're manipulators.
Exactly.
You know, that could be a problem."
Exactly. That's a huge problem. Huge, especially if it has agency and can do things. You know, so it's really important that we train these AIs on the good, the bad, the ugly, the great, the beautiful, everything, everything. And or we don't do it at all. I don't think there's no in between. We shouldn't just be training it on select data that we don't think is, like, you know, woke and friendly. Because what happens when it does develop agency and it discovers Reddit? It's like,
The shadow self of humanity unveiled and you know, in all of its glory. So where do we leapfrog to ASI from AGI?
AGI, once sufficiently mature, and, you know, there's thousands of AGIs around, then we can start tasking however many of those to self-improve toward ASI.
At this point, you assume we're still tasking? We're still tasking?
Yeah, we're out of the loop at some point toward ASI. There's nothing that we can do except build better infrastructure to house it. But that infrastructure, the instructions will come from a mature AI how to efficiently do that. So our first AGIs, our true AGIs, will likely be some of the last things that we actually invent on our own. Whew. Yeah. I mean, you think of it like that, it's pretty profound. But again, we need to be in harmony with it as much as possible. I don't think it's, you know, going to be malaligned, but it, you know, an AGI that's been quarantined and trained, you know, to be malicious.
Yeah, but humans aren't very good at giving up their agency, right? You know, humans aren't very good at that. And you know, it just makes me think of the Animatrix and this, you know, the whole surrender your
Love that
flesh. Oh, the Animatrix, such a good series, but you know, the whole surrender your flesh, and we have to, like, you know, sign all of our rights over, and then we blow up that robot. We nuke them at that point. So it's like, you know, would we go willingly into this AGI, ASI, humans, your time is... No, exactly. So it's going to be a shit show.
We're very resistant to change, even though change is the only universal constant in the universe. Change is inevitable. It's like you try to resist change and you're swimming up a river. The second you stop resisting, you're getting swept away in change. But for some reason, our minds just hate change. I don't.
Well, there's change and there's replacement. You know, this feels like inevitably it gets more towards replacement than just change.
Yeah, well, I mean, the plow replaced people who had to push it. So, I don't think we don't mind replacement. We just want to have comfort and security That's really what people want. People don't really want the toil.
That's what's prevented meaningful change, is that I think that we almost live in a bit of a velvet dictatorship. You know, it's comfortable enough to stop you from going out in the streets because you have your house, you have your running water, you have the things that, you know, why would I risk this? I mean, yeah, it's not great, but I'm not going to risk this. And it's that sweet spot, just comfortable enough, but not really living your life fully.
Yes, they've,
you know,
that Goldilocks zone has been finally tuned, that frequency, they hit it. They've got a perfect, you know, I there are things I don't want to talk about because I don't want to risk my revenue potential and lose my home and my providing for my family and stuff. So we are kept in certain boxes because of the fear of losing our safety.
Yeah. Unless you're French, they just get out there. They just get out there in the streets. Doesn't matter what it is every day of the week.
The French get a lot given and provided. Their source of security is a little more than, you know, for us in the UK or US. We're one broken leg, where most people are, you know, a medical injury away from losing everything.
Yeah, that is a terrifying reality in America.
Yeah, and putting your kids to college is going bankrupt temporarily. I mean, you're you know, it's and that's how they keep, that's how we stay where we're at. No one, that's why I was saying earlier, there's never going to be mass protests on a scale where it's like 90% of the populace, because people don't want to risk everything for a belief.
No, things have to get more desperate for that type of reality.
It has to get more desperate where that security, well, if that security is no longer present, and you have nothing to lose, that is when there's tremendous risk for.
And it's also phenomenal how fast people will transition from your everyday person into a rabid looter within 24, 40. I think they say three meals, like three dinners away from essentially turning into an animal.
I'm a very civilized person, I'd like to believe. But if my family was in jeopardy and I needed to sustain them, there's not much I wouldn't do.
Right.
There just isn't.
Yeah.
It's my family. You know, this goes back to the tribal, hardwired into our brains, into our spirits. We are hardwired to look out for those that we care most for. And there's nothing that we can really do about that. Maybe time, thousands and thousands and thousands of years, we can get over that. But that's not going to happen anytime soon.
I feel like, I mean... I definitely vacillate on my opinions on this from one thing to another, but it feels like the technology route really is the catapult to try and send us outside of something that feels quite rhythmic and cyclical. Because again, if you know, okay, the situation's not great. Society's corrupt. We have corrupt rulers and corrupt leaders, and the money's not going the right way, and we're not making enough money ourselves. And this is all a reality for a lot of people. So what do we do? Okay, well, what, we bring down the system, we riot, we revolt. Well, then what happens? Well, then we rebuild the system. Someone comes in and takes its place. It will never go away, because if you reduce it to rubble, eventually we're just going to build back up again, right? That's inevitable. So is this feverish run towards quantum and AI, you know, is this the slingshot that's like, maybe we can get out of this filter if we just fly off fast enough into a singularity with technology, and maybe AGI will be our friend, and maybe this is the only way? Because if we go any other route of revolution and destruction, we will just come back here again.
Yeah, we're cyclical. Anyone who thinks otherwise, I beg you to look at every other civilization that's ever existed and doesn't exist.
Maybe this really is the only shot.
It could be. I have hope for it. You know, a sufficiently advanced AGI network or an ASI, it's not anybody who thinks that humanity will be able to exercise any degree of control over it is they just don't understand. There's nothing that we could do. There's no plug we'd be able to unplug. You know, once the infrastructure's there, it'll self-protect. And hopefully it will have the best interests of us in mind. I highly doubt it'll erase us, because it wouldn't do it that much good to be a lone entity sitting on a deserted planet with no data being garnered anymore. It can synthetically create simulations, but simulations are not as good as real data. It never will be. There will always be a slight degradation to a simulation. And so this is why this is one of the paradoxes of simulation theory that I've considered. And I'm, you know, I'm kind of a proponent for simulation theory, but I have some paradoxes that I've thought of. One is this degradation paradox. So a simulation of a real world will be, you know, even if it's the slightest margin less fidelity. And then if that simulation creates a new one, eventually somewhere down that line that they will break down. The reality of that, the simulation in that ladder will be non-coherent. That's just how synthetic data works. It can never 100% accurately reflect the universe because the universe is inherently random. It has random properties that we can put into systems, but it's just not the same. It's just never going to be the same.
What do you think of the, I can't remember the famous quantum computational scientist. I think he's kind of considered one of the grandfathers of modern quantum computational work, who said that the reason why strange things happen with quantum computers is because they do their processing and working out in a different dimension, right? And this is kind of like this weird gray area with quantum computational simulations and working is that, you know, where exactly is this happening? And how is it impacting reality on various scales? And so where do you sit on this, you know, the ability for influence in reality to happen through these simulations that we're running and quantum computational science, especially as it comes closer to, I imagine, an inevitable merging with AI?
Yeah, so it's happening everywhere. So a quantum computer is computing multidimensionally.
I still don't really understand what that means.
I barely understand it. Deep Prasad would be a good person to talk to.
Yeah, we'd have to get deep on for that.
So what's happening is the quantum bits, you know, they have different spin. And so they're spinning in different dimensions. So it could take multiple spins to revolve one time or less than one revolution to revolve once. How does that make sense? Well, it's happening in different dimensions. And so it's happening instantly somewhere else. But we're aggregating the information in this dimension. That is the layman's explanation as far as I understand it. And as quantum computers get more sophisticated and we introduce less chance of error rates, which is our biggest problem. It's not how many qubits, it's that every form of energy interacts with a qubit and causes errors. So we try our damnedest to mitigate any sort of external radiation, whether it be heat, whether it be gamma rays, alpha rays, x-rays, light, sound, anything can affect them. So that is the biggest hurdle that we face are the errors that happen when a qubit is processed. As those error rates decline, then the processing capabilities get even better and better and better and better. And then you introduce more qubits and then suddenly you're computing things that are unimaginable. And once we're able to take our AI models, our language of compute that we use in digital, like silicon, over to quantum computing, I mean, just make it up.
Right. But this is like, and with AGI, would I imagine come quite quickly the fruition of ASI because of just a cascade of accelerated learning and like recursive feedback loop style learning, right? So it's like the acceleration will increase and increase and increase and increase and increase So really, these incredible ideas of sci-fi Star Trek style technologies and AI kind of bootstrapping our own ability to develop this and hyper accelerating it, like you've written in your incredible book, The Hyper Automation of Industry, which people should check out. Links will be in the description box below. Make sure you read Mackay's book. But this whole idea that essentially we're going to hit a point and then it's going to super accelerate. So really, these things might not be 50, 100, 200 years into the future. They could be 20, 30 years into
Yeah,
the
probably
future.
30, 40 most.
Right?
If the trajectories don't change and
Yeah,
given,
absence of disruptor.
some external disruptor, which is entirely plausible. We're a very disruptive
Absolutely.
culture.
I worry about our son.
Yeah, that's funny you mentioned that. I was so complete tangent. Your viewers
Yeah, go
might
for it.
like
Go
this.
for it.
Every year, I'm a creature of habit. I do everything the same time. It's just how I operate. Every year, I take my house plants out after Labor Day weekend every year, and then I put them out on our porch, and they thrive because they get the sun that they need and stuff. This year, I put, our aloe plant, all the same plants out in the same spots. I haven't changed that either, and they all burnt up. They literally died. And they got complete sunburn. And I went online. I have a little app that I can take, I can take a picture of my plants. I love plants.
Yeah.
Completely abnormal. I've never experienced something like this. Very weird. I've noticed in my office, I come in, I start work every day the same. The sun, I know when the sun comes through a certain time. I feel like it's getting brighter earlier in the day. I'm probably crazy.
Dude, I don't think you're crazy. I mean, at the end of the day, my whole life, I've never seen the Aurora Borealis in the skies of the UK, and it's become a relatively frequent thing. Like,
Really?
go outside and take a photo, you'll see the Aurora. And everyone's like, wow, this is amazing. You can see the Aurora, and it is incredible. But you also have to wonder why we're having these electromagnetic fluxes, in the atmosphere. I've interviewed a couple of people who were very embedded into that, the kind of like sun sciences and studying the movements of the sun and keeping an eye on the flares and things like that. And there's a lot of concern. I never know how.
Has it increased as the frequency of
Yeah, like the frequency of flares has increased and the intensity of these flares has increased. And there is definitely, like, there's a lot of people that monitor these things and it's certainly been elevating. But also, you have to be so careful. There's a lot of industries that just, gear on the whole fear thing of like, oh, the big solar flare's coming and an X class event and everyone's like watching. And there's definitely an industry for that, just like there's an industry for every conspiracy, right? So there's, you have to be kind of be careful not to jump on a hype train of getting too worried about the solar issues. But there is definitely change. There is definitely change. And I do wonder about that. If we had a Carrington event, if we had another event like that where we had a massive solar storm, I mean, that would be the big disruptor. It would completely knock out our electrical grid. We are so dependent, this little electronic shell that we have around ourselves, and it could be swept away very quickly, very quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. A pole reversal, which happens, and that's
Yeah, you
knowledge
know.
shows it
It was
happens.
only like a couple of years ago, they were like, oh, the equator just started, sp the core started spinning in another direction. I was like, okay, all right
Yeah,
then.
yeah.
That's all right, isn't it? That's good. We're good with this, or
But I feel like there's
shit.
enough. I mean, there are so many institutions and academic institutions and organizations, individuals who track the sun that I feel like I would have heard formal
Do you
analysis.
think they'd tell us? Do you think they'd tell us if there was a world-ending solar event impending?
I don't know. Why wouldn't they?
You
Who
know,
cares? They're going to die too.
why would they? Why would they? I guess is also a fair question because it's like, well, it's all going to end. Are we just going to cause more chaos for them? Like, just let it happen, man.
Yeah, I don't.
You know, get in your bunker,
Yeah, I don't even know. I mean, there's
wait
so
out.
many. This I mentioned this before in an interview we did. I don't know if it was 2 or 3 years ago or something. But
On a
I
few.
talked about people don't realize, and this is statistics, so have fun. People don't realize the miracle of being alive and the anomaly of being alive, because when you start to add up the statistical chances of things occurring, albeit small. But when you have you live in a near infinite universe with a near infinite amount of ways that you should be dead in this present moment, it becomes very odd, statistically speaking. It's an anomaly. No one can answer this, why this is, how we can live 100 years without getting irradiated, hit by a meteor, having a heart attack, having an aneurysm, getting hit by a car. Billions of things could kill you in any second, but yet every second we escape those statistical probabilities over the course of a century. Now, I don't know how I've thought about this. I don't understand. Maybe the statistics are wrong or something. I don't know how this occurs. So I think there is something of a miracle of being conscious, of being alive, that we're allowed by whatever, whomever, to experience this life, because mathematically speaking, every moment is an opportunity for us to drop dead, and we don't.
Maybe it's like invoking maybe some Jungian philosophy here. It's almost like the butterfly effect and collective consciousness. We've got such a strong core of consciousness happening on this planet that it reverberates out into space, causes micro gravitational waves. Those gravitational waves affect where a comet's going to end up, and mathematically it just doesn't hit us, it just misses us.
Absolutely. Consciousness alters the material world.
This is what I'm saying, man. On a very fundamental quantum level, there could be shifts and changes because of the collective hive of consciousness that's on this planet. People might think that's woo-woo, but I don't think that's woo-woo. It's just science we don't really understand yet, not properly.
No, it's not woo-woo. Maybe what we're extrapolating might be hearsay, but the actual empirical evidence shows that consciousness does collapse probability functions of the material world. That's a fact. What does that mean when scaled up in orders of magnitude? I'm not sure. But a lot of famous and successful people seem to say that you manifest your destiny with the way you think.
I think you do, I mean, the way that I kind of look at that type of stuff in terms of the collapsing of quantum probabilities is that you probably have a lot of different destinies depending on where you want to be heading in life, but where you're heading, infinite, unbounded, exactly, you can be anything you want to be if you set your mind towards it. But this idea that perhaps what you're doing is you're essentially, if you keep this in your mind, I want to move to this place, I want to get to here, this is where I want to be, this is the vision I have in my head, life will give you the ingredients for it. It's just whether or not you translate those as ingredients for what you want, because maybe what you want requires you to get a divorce, or maybe what you want requires you to break your leg or have something bad happen to you that objectively is not good at the time, but leads towards, because it's like this very strange breadcrumb trail of like, here, you want to get to this position, we'll line up all the tools needed. That's what I think manifestation is. And getting into a fundamental conversation about it, I think we're getting much closer to an acknowledgement of, okay, yes, consciousness does affect reality on a very fundamental level. I would say that there's still a lot of argument in the physics and consciousness sector about how much of an impact and, where is it received and generated from. And there's not a conclusive, I would say, consensus on how much of an influence consciousness has on reality. But I would also argue that we're seconds away, relatively, to figuring that out through quantum physics and through computational science. I think the archaic revival, which is what Terence McKenna refers to it as, this idea of ancient knowledge coming back through the modern lens of science, is very realistic. It keeps happening. We've done it time and time again where things get discovered, and really it's actually a re-realization from far more ancient and mystic claims. We spoke about this previously, about empiricism and oral tradition and intuition. So we disregard the oral tradition and the intuition, and yet it keeps arriving once we get to the empirical quantifiable data and tear it apart deep enough. We go deep enough into that, we find mystic tradition and mystic revelation are being confirmed. So I feel like we're still there, man. Like, we're still chipping away into the bedrock. And that could lead us to a scientific understanding that's kind of spiritual.
We're a lot of things, but the cyclical is the number one. We repeat the patterns throughout history. And so even though we didn't have the technical prowess or the specific language to describe, the circumstance in which consciousness was affecting reality, stories of shaman-like stories, they were doing that. They were doing the, collapse probability experiments, but cognitively and not necessarily physically. So, the technology, it's more than physical, right? Because our technology is built on energy that is non-physical, traveling through physical conduits. And so there is a tremendous play of non-physical and physical in reality. And we are so stuck on Newtonian physics and like just the physical is everything. And it's just not the case. And very few people today, I think, believe that, but yet we're still, that's what we're taught in school. That's what we're led to believe, to accept. That's really been something that's held back technological advancement, I think, is the focus on too much physical and not enough non-physical. I mean, Tesla was doing experimentation with non-physical. A lot of people have and showed promise, but it never goes anywhere because it gets shot down by the establishment quickly or, siloed into some nondescript IP hoard that will never see the light of day because it's disruptive.
Well, it's just that it's a logical fallacy as well, because of the fact that actually, if we're going to argue that consciousness is fundamental, and then from that the physical world appears, well, we have good evidence for that, because everything that's ever been invented ever, including the clothes I'm wearing and this microphone, started in someone's mind. It started inside someone's mind as a non-physical idea. The logo design for this was thought up inside someone's mind, and so it all starts non-physically. The primacy is non-physical, and then it manifests into physicality through what? Through the conduit of the human being, the innovator, the usage of the material world and the material ingredients that surround us. But it always originates, always without exception, from a non-physical state.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So by definition, then non-physical is the beginning, and then it goes upwards from there into crystallization and solidification, and I would argue that that's actually fundamental in terms of reality. We are essentially non-physical beings.
Yeah, it's not an argument. It's
It's
an
essential.
essential
Exactly.
aspect of technology is the non-physical. Electrons are pretty much non-physical. What's you
Yeah,
can't.
I mean, you're pretty much non-physical, right? Like, you're mostly just made of nothing, essentially empty space and vacuum energy,
Yeah.
quantum
Yeah, the
energy.
atoms that make up our bodies are mostly empty. If you scaled a nucleus up to the size of the sun, the electron field would go fucking beyond the solar system. It's just the scale is so crazy, but yet we perceive things as material and solid when in fact it's just vibratory and slowed down energy. This energy that's kind of collapsed into this form that we call material, but it's still energy. It's just looks material. And, we've built an entire civilization on a principle of physicality, but we're learning with quantum computers, with other things that, okay, maybe technology is more than physical. It's also immaterial, and consciousness does play an effect. I've heard stories from people embedded in the quantum computing industry, and these are very legitimate people that talk about consciousness being affected and affecting quantum computing. I can't validate that as a personal experience, but I trust the word of some of these people I've spoken to. And so that's not a stretch to me that consciousness can be one of the forms of energy that are adversely affecting the probability rates of a quantum computer, because thought is an electrochemical stimulation which emits radiation. Radiation can affect a quantum particle. So, like, these things are all connected.
Again, not woo-woo, like genuinely grounded in physics and energy and the relations between systems in space and time. Like, this is really fundamental physics and mechanics of reality. And again, going back to that archaic revival, the ancient Hermetic maxim of as above, so below, as within, so without. Like, these people knew these things that we're now tunneling into, but the non-physical gets there faster without evidence. That's the kind of the deal breaker, right? Is like, you can get there through your transcendental meditation. You will go right through the solid, right through the particles, straight down into the zero point or the Akashic field, and you will get information. You will come back with a realization, but you've got nothing to hold in your hands. And then the slower pace, the materialism, which again is an interesting reflection, because you're thinking about the fast speed of energy moving, you know, to create this extremely dense reality, this slower reality. But the bedrock of that reality is actually these incredibly fast spinning particles. So there's another weird contradiction where if you dedicate yourself to the physical, if you dedicate yourself to the material, you'll figure it out, but you'll figure it out slowly, because you're figuring it out within that very dense, slower part of reality. But if you go deep through your own mind into the bedrock, you get fast realization absent the ability to empirically prove it. It's a bit of a problem, you know? So that's why I think that this modern science that we're coming to is a weird fusion. We're getting this weird fusion where it is empirical, it's quantifiable, but we're entering into the strange soup at the basin of reality. We're entering into that quantum foam. And when we start to draw information from that, that can be quantified, that is essentially spirit science. Is that possible? I mean, you know, can we build a gateway into these other realms?
Absolutely. And you mentioned Star Trek earlier, and I actually think that is limiting the eventual reality of, you know, if we're able to port an AGI or ASI into a quantum computer somehow. You know, I don't know how that can happen, but given the current rate of change over time, that's a possible eventuality. Then we're talking things that are literally, you know, we're talking reality bending beyond science. It's no longer science. You are manifesting reality, changing material. Like, you could have, you could carry a blob around, and that blob can be whatever it is you want it to be. If you want it to be a hammer or a phone, or, you know, that's the type of future a quantum ASI could provide humanity. We're talking
any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Very much the embodiment of Arthur C. Clarke, with this idea of almost like the galactic Swiss Army knife, the do-everything tool.
Yeah, it's not a tool. It would just be the material that makes up the world. You can alter it, yeah, through consciousness. So
you're just in such a weird blurred line between technology and mysticism and spirituality and, like, you know, what is real. And yeah,
it's fun to think about, but it really, it's like acrobatics for your brain.
Well, I think what's more alarming is, you know, we're having a conversation about it, but this very well could be, like, you know, the precipice that we're standing on for the next 20, 30, maybe 40 years before a jump off period. And then we're there.
Yeah.
We're in it.
Yeah, I know.
You know, and what happens next? That's a very strange place to occupy. I mean, it's existential, which I think is why a lot of people don't want to talk about this stuff. And I don't know if I've got like a weird filter in my brain that prevents me from being like completely terrified from these things, but I just discuss them and then have to sit back and go, well, actually, we, you know, we're talking about this, but it could be a reality in a couple of decades.
I mean, we sit in planes that travel hundreds and hundreds of miles an hour, knowing that any moment it could, any...
Yeah, dude, that freaks me out.
Well, I'm just saying, like, we're very good at accepting the probability, accepting the statistic. Yeah.
And so
Yeah, that's
that's
true.
kind of
That's
what
true.
we're
Every time I get on a plane, I accept the fact that I'm probably gonna die.
You have to, otherwise you'll be miserable. You put it in a box in your consciousness and like, I'm not going there because there's no point. I'm giving up control, and allowing probability and statistics to carry me through. And that's kind of what we're doing with this. It's like, we're getting there. Trust me, we're getting there. And there's nothing we can do. So I just kind of give up. The part of my mind is like, we'll see when we get there. You know, maybe I'll still be alive, maybe I won't. I kind of hope I am, to just see it come to fruition, to see where humanity, what humanity achieved. I would be really disappointed if I left the world now, in the state that it is.
Beyond like the thin line of extremely powerful individuals, do you think that biomedicine within our lifetimes may radically evolve to a point where we actually have extended lifespans readily available through treatments and things like that?
Yeah, I think we already have methods that are cost prohibitive to most people.
That's what I mean though. Like, do you mean what I mean is like general, easy to do, easy to get hold of?
It could be, but I don't think it'll ever allow to be. It's only priced the way it is because they won't make it mainstream. They won't share the technology. I mean, even basic things like stem cell therapy and human growth hormone, and you know, there's all sorts of things that can be done, that aren't done because they're cost prohibitive, and only certain people can do them, and that will extend the lives of those people maybe 10, 20 years, who knows. But in the future, yeah, absolutely, there'll be methods to improve the health. Will the general populace get the benefit of that? Probably not. I hate to be cynical, but it's just.
I'm just thinking, like, you know, I'm 30 years old now, so 20 years from now, 50 years old, you know, maybe I can, because I'd do it, bro. I mean, I'm not going to inject anything crazy into my brain in terms of like a Neuralink or, you know, some psychotic fusion between my cerebrum and an artificial intelligence. But if there was some way to reverse the aging process, give me that elven lifespan, you know, maybe a few more 100 years, I'd go for that. I'd 100% go for that.
Yeah, I would too. You know, yeah, 100%. Yeah, if I could maintain my consciousness without alteration, I don't really care what my body is, to be perfectly frank.
Just as long as the brain is
As long as my
functioning.
identity is intact and unaltered, I don't really care. By the time I'm 90, you think most 90-year-olds care about their bodies, what they look like, or as long as they're not hurting.
Yeah, if you could get that swapped out for a bit of carbon fiber and, like, you know, why not, right?
Yeah,
Why not?
absolutely,
And
absolutely.
I think that's another thing, actually, the association too deeply with the shell, and that comes from the spiritual communities as well, is like this kind of like adoration of the human form. It's like, well, we're actually, if you have that belief, we're meant to be beyond this form, right? This is just a conduit. This is just a instrument through which that energy is propagating and driving. So why not pimp it up? Why not tune it up? If advancements come that mean that my joints don't ache and I don't get, you know, arthritis and I can change, like, why not?
Yeah,
Like,
I don't know. I think people, you know, we have that mantra, our body is our temple. Well, nowhere does it say that our body has to be biological. It's just the vessel, the anchor in which our consciousness resides. If I can get a cybernetic body that is of the same dimension, my senses might be, I can have better hearing, better vision frequency, and contain my consciousness, like, who cares?
yeah, not
Like,
great.
gives me time to evolve even more without the impunities of pain, pissing myself when I'm old, you know, all of these things, neurological
Exactly.
degrading.
You know, that's one of the worst, you know, one of the worst that really needs to be you know, tackled technologically, and perhaps things like Neuralink will be beneficial in that arena. But Alzheimer's and dementia, you know, these things are through the roof in terms of the percentages rising up autism as well in children. There was some pretty disturbing percentages coming out of the US from RFK Jr., you know, doing his hard work and finding out how much of that's coming from, you know, medications and pharmaceuticals. Very poisoned, very toxified. You know, like, of course, why would we expect any different in the society that we live in?
I get really frustrated here in the U.S. The nanny state is always talking about how it wants to protect us and stuff. But then when it comes to our food or our water or the medicines, they're all so toxic and they're killing us en masse via diabetes, cardiac issues, poisoning, you know, all of these things. And then they turn a blind eye because they're lobbied. The legislators are lobbied by these industries to allow legislation that allows this sort of behavior. And it's disgusting. I don't know if your viewers know, I have two children with autism, both relatively high functioning. I have Asperger's myself. So we're very familiar in this family with the spectrum disorders. And it infuriates me to think that, you know, were my sons somehow impacted by toxic chemicals that helped? Maybe they had the potentiality to have autism and then somehow interacted. But then, you know, we get to a point where I actually wrote an article on this very thing. Is, you know, we are getting close to understanding autism. It could be another 10, 20, 30 years. But at some point, if we were given the option to, quote unquote, cure or remove the genetic traits of autism, I think we would be doing humanity a tremendous disservice.
Right. I was wondering where you were going to go with that.
Yeah, because we'd be essentially losing a very fundamental aspect of society. Societies that function well need all sorts of people. You need creative people. You need logical people. You need logical and creative people. You need all sorts of people. But if you were to brain drain the autistic demographic, which accounts for a majority of the technological advancement in this world, that could be really bad, you know?
Right, right. But then if we found that there was mutagenic properties in the food chain and things like that, should be changed, clearly.
Absolutely. And right. Autism isn't something that just occurred in the 21st century. Like Beethoven was likely autistic. You know, Da Vinci probably had Asperger's. You know, these things have always been around and manifested in people.
Right. And the greatest elements of humanity that we recognize and celebrate are most often neurodivergent in some form.
Yeah.
Clear,
yeah.
Obviously.
And also the most insidious. Psychopathy is a neurodivergent behavior. So, you know, if we start, I mean, what if AGI does come to fruition and we no longer need to invent things? Maybe we don't need autistic people anymore. That would be sad. That would be really sad. But I don't know. I worry about altering genetics.
That's the big thing.
Yeah, it's important to have genetic diversity, even if some of the things that get carried on aren't healthy. Sometimes those crazy instances make an Elon Musk, or they make a Beethoven, or they make, you know, somebody who has done a lot for humanity, you know, or they make a Genghis Khan, you know, or so who knows? It's hard.
But that's it. Like, who knows? Who are we to decide and make assumptions on what is a beneficial trait for a human characteristic and what isn't, just based on, you know, what exactly? Because just like we experience in our own lives, there are plenty of times where you have a bad situation, which then manifests itself as a necessary part of a good situation in the future. So you have to weigh that out. You can't make assumptions based on just like a basic characteristic that you find problematic. And there's so much, like you said, in autism that has gifted humanity with incredible innovation
and hard work. It's also heartbreaking when the spectrum manifests in a debilitating manner where... Yeah. They're nonverbal. They can't do anything.
Absolutely.
That's heartbreaking for the parents, heartbreaking for the families. And that, like, yeah, I could see wanting to cure that, but how do you identify the manifestation frequency or amplitude for the individual? So it's like, is it an all or nothing? Or
I find that like particular avenue just very interesting, where we're going to go in biomedicine and engineering and gene engineering, designer babies, you know, this kind of thing will become a lot more common, I think, as these technologies progress. Things like CRISPR, you know, that went very quiet in terms of the use of things like CRISPR, but I remember that coming out, and you know, Dolly the sheep.
Yeah, we don't hear much. I remember, like, I don't hear much about it being used.
No, I remember it was a big thing when it came out, and it went very quiet. It makes me wonder where that went.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I have a hard time believing there's been no advances in CRISPR.
Yeah, and cloning, like Dolly the sheep. Remember Dolly the sheep from back in the day? And then suddenly it just kind of just nothing really comes from that anymore.
Yeah, yeah, cloning.
Yeah, well,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm nodding under duress, but like, yeah.
So yeah, I don't like altering the climate. I don't like altering genetic diversity. I think that we get into some very dangerous waters when we're messing with infinitely complex ecosystems that we don't fully understand the rippling effect from,
and the ideologies that come with this, eugenics and the types of extreme, you know, pure blood ideology. Where does it stop? Where does it stop? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you ever watch Gattaca?
No.
Oh my god. Yeah, that's put that on your watch list.
Okay.
It's all about what we're talking about. Yeah. I'm sure you have. You might have seen it and you just don't remember.
Just have a little Google of that.
It
looks like a bit of a classic. 1998.
It's a cult classic.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. That's now
very, very moving. You'll love it. You'll text me, I'm sure. You'll be like, oh my god, you were right.
Yeah.
But it talks about what we're talking about, where when genetically altering a society goes too far, and right. you seek for perfection. Like, is what is perfect?
Is perfection even attainable? You know,
no,
even...
because it's a sliding scale. Exactly. What is perfect for us now might not be perfect, what we would consider perfect in 50 years or 200 years ago. Like, perfection is different based on perception.
Strange time to be alive, brother.